Hey guys, how's it going? All right, well, good, I guess. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on Liberty Radio Network. I'm live noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. Every day here, LRN.FM or LibertyRadioNetwork.com. Also on Sunday mornings, I'm on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. I have no idea who I'm going to have on this Sunday for you. Let me think. I don't know. I guess you'll have to tune in and find out. And, yeah, you can find all my archives at scotthorton.org, except you can't today because the website is still down. Because the thing broke, and I guess it's hard to put back together again or something. I don't know. It's far away from here. I can't tell. But anyway, I can now receive emails. I still can't send them. But if you emailed me and it bounced, you could try again now. If you think I owe you an email, but you're not sure if I got it, go ahead and try again. Otherwise, I don't know. But at least I can get emails now. Scott at scotthorton.org. All right. Anyway, but usually, go ahead and memorize the URL anyway. It's pretty easy. It's just my name, scotthorton.org. I'm not truly an organization, but some other guy has .com. And so, you see the problem. But anyway, scotthorton.org, a lot of the time, I got content there for you. 3,700 something interviews going back to 2003. And, yeah, big apologies to everybody who had to wait a week to hear any of these. I've gotten a lot of nice tweets, I guess nice, saying, hey, man, come off with the damn interviews. Put them on YouTube. Do something. How the hell am I supposed to not have your interviews to listen to? I'm sorry, man. Honestly, I would prefer to have it where you could have them. Prefer to have it where you can have them. That's what I'm trying to say. But anyway, I guess we'll see. All right. Today on the show, it'll be a good show. Many of you won't hear this until much, much later, I guess. But today on the show, live, we will have James Bovard, the author of a great many libertarian books, and a hell of a lot of great articles about Waco, the atrocity from 22 years ago this Sunday. So we're going to talk about Waco and why it matters, what it means, and what it did with Jim Bovard. And then also Roger Charles is going to be on. He's the co-author of a book, Oklahoma City, what the investigation missed and why it matters still. And they have an interesting dynamic, those two stories together. One is supposed to be the somehow the after-the-fact justification for the other. I don't know how it is now, really, out there in the world so much. I should try it. But it used to always be, if you ever try to say anything about Waco, they'd say, oh yeah, well what about Oklahoma City? Well, what about it? Like the Branch Davidians, before they died, went forward in time 2 years and blew up that building, retroactively justifying their own murder at the hands of the FBI and the Delta Force? What the hell sense does that make? Anyway, doesn't have to make sense. As long as it's a pro-government slogan. So anyway, Jim Bovard on Waco and Roger Charles on the Oklahoma City bombing that came 2 years later, 20 years ago, this Sunday. So that's coming up. That'll be good. And then also, I got a lot of news to talk about with you, too. So let me start with Rand Paul. You know, like, what did he think? This wasn't going to happen? Everybody says he's a sexist or whatever. Maybe that's because the women are the only ones who are brave enough to challenge him on all his flip-flopping. So when they say, you say this now, but you used to say that, he goes, well, I did not. And he gets all whiny. It's very unbecoming of a presidential candidate. But anyway, so this is, you know, this is the very best of the stuff. And what was he going to do? You know, I tried, and I don't know if his campaign really worked on this or what, but I just know because of my mind's eye, I just know I saw a speech that he gave outdoors in the sunshine at some event back in 07 or 08, citing Michael Scheuer and citing Robert Pape and explaining that September 11th and all the Al-Qaeda terrorism that preceded it was caused by American intervention in the Middle East that preceded it. So there's your challenge, BuzzFeed. There's video of this kind of thing. But they found the audio of him in 2007. Saying that American foreign policy in the Middle East was the reason for terrorism. Now, if you saw Rand Paul being interviewed by Sean Hannity last week, you could see where everything controversial he ever said, he said, oh, I was just running, helping my dad campaign back then. Now I'm a senator. Now I'm my own man. Now I don't say those things anymore. And Hannity's just letting him slide. What do you mean Iran is no threat? But he didn't challenge him on this. What do you mean Al-Qaeda was motivated by Bill Clinton's foreign policy in the 1990s? That couldn't possibly be. Hannity didn't say. And you know what's funny? Is this BuzzFeed article, which is clearly written in the most scandalous Daily Mail type of a format here. Oh my God, Rand Paul said that the U.S. government had provoked the attack by doing horrible things to people before the attack happened. But they don't come right out and say that's absurd. And in fact, it sort of looks here, if I maybe I remember wrong. It looks like maybe they updated this article. Where they do actually cite bin Laden's fatwa and what he said about the occupation of the Saudi bases in order to enforce the blockade against the people of Iraq. So they do actually stop and say he's right. I think they changed this article. Maybe I read it too fast last night, but I don't remember this paragraph until I just refreshed it. Where they go, actually, yeah, that's true. Before, it was much more, I think, breathless and just, oh my goodness, can you believe that Rand Paul would say this? And then, but you're not, I guess you're supposed to fill in yourself whether you're not supposed to say it because it's a politically incorrect thing to say, that it's a gaffe, that it's a scandal because it's true. Or that's so absurd that Giuliani has heard a lot of absurd explanations for September 11th. But the idea that anyone that Bill Clinton killed in Iraq from bases in Saudi motivated people to do it, support for the Israelis in their permanent occupations of the Middle East, why, that's just crazy. Is that why we're supposed to reject it? We're all supposed to forget that the 20th century ever happened? Is that how it goes? So anyway, this leads to the operative point, which is Rand Paul refused to comment. BuzzFeed asked him about this, and they haven't figured out what are they going to say about this. He's already changed his tune. They point out here his news story is they hate us because radical Islam. He is not going to stand on that most important position that his father made back, and which was, of course, and I've mentioned this before, but it's absolutely true, and it proves my point 100%, that the movie, How Ron Paul Watered the Withered Tree of Liberty, Revolution for Liberty, something. It's got a big, long title, but you can find it. It's like an hour and a half long, awesome documentary. And it was the Giuliani, the brave stand against Giuliani, that made Ron Paul, Rand Runs Away. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey, guys. Welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean. Coming up, Jim Bovard and then Roger Charles.
Right? Yeah.
In that order. First of all, man, I've been putting this off and just putting it off, but I gotta tell you about this. I swear I'll get back to the wars in just a second. But, you gotta look at this article, man. It's just great. It's called Navy Builds Ship for F-35. Ship needs months of upgrades to handle F-35. And that's putting it, very politely. It's not the greatest headline, but it says a lot in it. You know what I mean? It's at Foxtrot Alpha. So Google that. It's by Tyler Rogaway. Rogoway. Tyler Rogaway. And it's about this new giant aircraft carrier, and it's called the USS America. And if it was the Roman gods mocking us, they couldn't do a better job than with this thing. And it's straight out of, you guys all read 1984 when you were in high school, which is why you're so anti-war all the time, right? So, in 1984, the good guy, Winston Smith, he's befriended by the guy who's going to end up torturing him. Spoiler. But before he tortures him, he says, you know, he brings him kind of in and explains, here's what's going on. And he gives him the secret book of, here's how we do it. You know, to kind of make it plain to you, the reader, what the hell's going on here. And he says in there, the only reason we build the floating fortress is to take your money and sink it into the ocean where you can't get to it. That's what it's all about. Taking whatever excess productivity you could build up for yourself that would, you know, make you less than desperate. And we take rocket ships and we blast your money off into space. We build these floating fortresses just to sink your money into the ocean so that you can't have it. So you can't better yourself with it. And also so they can't have it because, you know, there are privileges at the higher levels of the party apparatus, you understand. But anyway, so that's what I thought of when I read this. And then I love that it's the USS America, right? They ran out of fake heroes to name it after. They said, well, let's just call it the USS America. And then here's the thing. The whole purpose of this boat, supposedly, is to carry around a bunch of F-35s, which we're supposed to believe are the most advanced fighters and this and that, even though they are outclassed by the F-18s and the F-15s and the F-16s that they're replacing. I guess they already chucked all the F-14s. But anyway. The F-35 is a complete piece of crap for 175 reasons we've been over and over on this show. Maybe I'll get back to that in a second if I have a second. But the damn thing is certainly no better than a fleet of F-15s or F-18s. But anyway, it can't even talk to this boat. This super, whatever, what class of aircraft carrier is this? It's a big one. It's not some kind of junior aircraft carrier. It's a 45,000 ton displacement boat, however much that is. Cost $6.8 billion. And then here's the deal. Not only can this ship not talk to the F-35 because of computer compatibility type thing? Oh, it's not going to be able to for a long, long time either. You have to basically start its entire communication system over from scratch in a, you know, like Joseph Heller wrote this damn thing. And then, or Orwell himself. And then, get this, the F-15, they said, oh yeah, no, if a Harrier jump jet can take off from it, then the F-35 can take off from it. No. The F-35, one thing that it apparently can do is take off vertically or somewhat vertically, but if it does that from this boat, it'll burn a hole right through the damn deck. So, yeah, they're going to have to completely redo the entire deck of the entire ship. They're going to end up sinking this damn boat. I think you know what I mean. So, yeah. They built an entire new aircraft carrier that's a complete and total useless piece of crap just to service the F-35, the useless piece of crap. Well, the piece of crap that has one use, transferring money from the Treasury Department to people in the Air Force and their counterparts at Lockheed. And their subcontractors, that's it. It's just a giant screw job. And they talk about, oh, the Chinese and the Russians have all these fifth and sixth generation planes that we'll never be able to beat. You know what? Throw up a fleet of F-15s and see what you can do. They claim that it's all the F-35. Well, okay, it's not really stealthy. And yeah, it can only carry two bombs. And it's not fast. And it can't climb fast. And it doesn't turn well. And... but man, does it have some sophisticated electronicals on board, though, huh? It's so electronic, everybody, they say. Well, if that's even true, so what? You can swap all that out and put it in the nose cone of an F-15, too, can't you? Give me a break. The whole thing is, again, simply, it's a con. Like missile defense. It's just about taking your money away from you. Blasting it off into space, sinking it into the ocean. And, you know, I just happen to have another one. I mean, these come out every week. There are new ones like this. The first versions, oh, but don't worry. But the first versions of the F-35s, they admit, will not outdo an A-10 in battlefield capabilities. Yeah, of course not. And, you know, we talked with Andrew Coburn on the show about this, too, about how... and you guys all know this story, right? The F-35 is supposed to blast ground targets at close quarters engagement with American ground forces. You know, going hundreds and hundreds of miles an hour at altitude with super smart weapons that it doesn't have and can't use. And the cameras for design in the 90s and the gun doesn't work. But meanwhile, the A-10s can fly in low and slow and they're heavily armored. And the pilot sits in what they call a titanium bathtub of armor, and it can take a hit, and it can fly low and slow and use eyeballs, the very best intelligence, to differentiate on the ground who they're killing and try to shoot the bad guys and spare the lives of the guys that they're supposedly saving. You try to fight, bring close quarter airstrikes and ground battles with B-1s and F-35s, it's all just friendly fire waiting to happen. Anybody can see that. But it's all politics. And I'm not saying that America should have ground wars in other people's countries. But I'm just pointing out the absurdity of the fact that we have ground wars in other people's countries. The A-10 is actually useful for that. And mostly it's just politics. Every article that you read about this, or any in-depth look at it, will say, the Air Force hates being air cover for the Army. They don't want to do that. They want to fly fast and be more macho, not in a supporting role. Right? Like they're just brats.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. And so today's April the 17th. Guess close we're going to get. So time for our annual Waco show. I got James Bovard on the line. He's a great libertarian journalist and the author of a hell of a lot of great books. Shakedown. The latest is Public Policy Hooligan, the memoir. You should get that, man. It's really good. But before that, also, there's Freedom in Chains, The Bush Betrayal, Attention Deficit Democracy, which is my very favorite one, The Fair Trade Fraud, The Farm Fiasco, Terrorism and Tyranny, Lost Rights, and I think there's more than that that I didn't get to, but a pile of really great books. And back in the 1990s and all the way since then, too, he's been writing about the travesty of what happened at the so-called compound of the Branch Davidians outside of Waco, Texas, back in 1993. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Hey, doing good, Scott. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for keeping the fires of Waco burning. It's something you've done a great job of. It's great how you've been doing this almost every year, going on almost 20 years now. So you've helped keep this issue alive.
Geez, it really has been. Not quite that long, but yeah, getting into the teens here. Yeah, you know, well, it happened 100 miles from my door, and it was such an obvious lie to me at the time. And then it's the whole getting away with it thing. As I learned about Nixon when I was a kid, it's always the cover-up that really gets him in trouble. Well, in this one, I guess it got the cover-up got him in trouble with me more than even the travesty. It's the constantly being lied to right to my face that really pisses me off. And also the mass murder.
Well, yeah, and it's this is something which I think helped make a lot of people more radical. It did that for you. It did that for Angela Keaton. And there are so many other people who are listening to your show right now who are probably driven, whose eyes were opened up to the nature of Leviathan because of what the feds did in Waco and all the lies they told afterward.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. A huge part of my political development. You know, I was 15 at the time, and I like to bear witness, as long as I mention it, to I was sacking groceries at the local grocery store there, and all the white, upper-middle-class housewives of northwest Austin, Texas, were unanimous in the instant death penalty for these people. Just go in there and end it, they would say. He said he was Jesus. Nail him to a tree. And this kind of thing where it was completely out of control. So, like, it was when the government did finally go in there and end it, as they said, they truly were carrying out the will of the democracy, at least, you know, in the nice part of Austin, Texas, anyway, nicest part.
Well, and, yeah, it was interesting to see how the government shaped that consensus by this one pile of lies after another from the day when the ATF first assaulted it. The whole notion the ATF had been ambushed, the notion that the Branch Davidians had fired first, the notion that the feds were simply trying to serve a search warrant based on ginned-up evidence and false charges, by the way, when the ATF had planned all along to do a military-style assault on a peaceful home on a Sunday morning.
All right, so rewind a little bit, and in fact, I got an apology to make here. I gave a presentation about the wars to some Young Americans for Liberty students at Baylor University, and they asked me about Waco, and maybe I sounded glib or something when I said that the Branch Davidians were a breakoff group of the Seventh-day Adventists, and I guess that was taken to mean that I was saying Seventh-day Adventists are crazy cult people or whatever, when to me that was sort of the mark of how normal they were. There's nothing wrong with being a Seventh-day Adventist. And they were a break-off group. Now, it's true, maybe I should have clarified, they broke off back in the 1930s, this particular group. They went way back and all of that. But that was like, I probably said that in an effort just to show how normal they were for people from Central Texas, that they were, you know, basically a sect of Protestant Christians, not a Charles Manson cult like they were portrayed as being, you know. But instead, yeah, I mean, came off like I was insulting Adventists, which I never meant to.
Well, it's unfortunate that some people interpret your comments that way. Knowing you and having seen you speak, I would assume that you were, you know, fair and even-handed and just explaining it and not doing backflips to make sure that no one got offended, which it's unfortunate people did. But the fact is, these are folks who were living in that part of Texas. They were peaceful. They had guns, but there's Texas. Texans have guns. It's not like New Jersey, for God's sake. And it was the feds who decided to make a target of them and to make an issue of them. And then the folks at the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, had a huge campaign based largely on false charges, and it was the false claims of a drug nexus, which allowed them to get the National Guard helicopters, which were flying over top of the Branch Davidian home during the raid. And according to some folks, they were shooting into the home during the time that the small army of ATF agents were assaulting it from the front.
Yeah, and now, so one of the things that I tried to drive home with those students was to go look at this documentary, at least one of the two or three here by Mike McNulty and others, Waco, The Rules of Engagement. This really, I think, does the best job of laying the groundwork for a much more accurate narrative than the one that we were all fed on TV at the time.
And something which is really good about Waco Rules of Engagement, which won an Emmy and was a finalist for the best documentary at the Academy Awards. It walks people through in a way, it humanizes the victims of the government, who the FBI and others made a big effort to tar after almost everybody died in the FBI final assault. And it shows the absurdity of a lot of the policy assumptions that the feds were making. It makes it clear that the feds were lying basically from the start, that a number of the federal officials knew they were lying, and yet most of the media just rolled over and was happy to be a government tool. And it was very telling that April 19th was the day of the final FBI assault, and in the days after that, the Washington Press Corps made Attorney General Janet Reno a hero, basically because she had been tough, she had stood up, so on and so forth. But basically, you have all these dead Americans, a lot of dead foreigners as well, after a reckless federal attack. And what does the media do? Thank God for Janet Reno.
Yeah. It's funny the way they can just flip that around.
Funny is one word for it.
Yeah. Well, now, so, yeah, because it really was sort of like we're seeing right now with Hillary Clinton, where, hey, what are you, sexist? Why are you attacking Janet Reno? You just don't like her because she's a woman attorney general, or just somehow change the subject. It's amazing it works. It's not funny, but it is amazing that it works.
Well, it's so craven, and it was self-evidently craven, and you're kind of wondering, okay, so she's a hero with 80 people dead, 80 people that did not have to die. I mean, what the hell does a person have to do to be a non-hero?
Yeah. Well, and you know, you made a very important point when you mentioned in talking about the film, how it humanizes the people there, shows some of the home video footage of them and this kind of thing. Again, you know, I remember this time very well. I was a kid at the time, but still, that, you know, it was really like Saddam Hussein in Iraq, right? There's only one Iraqi, Saddam. There's only one Davidian, David Koresh. And they never told us anything about anyone else there other than basically they were all hostages of this crazy cult leader. But other than that, they were like, you know, the faceless people from the Pink Floyd videos or whatever, where they just, they kind of were unhuman. And so, they were no big loss, really. If it'll shut that Koresh guy up and I can go back to my game shows, then loss, you know, because they hardly existed.
Yeah, something that was really amazing about that is that the press corps was so anxious to put a halo over Janet Reno that she was given credit for being concerned, someone from the FBI or who knows where, Janet Reno would never say, if memory serves, as someone had told her that the children in there were being abused. And that was why, you know, Janet Reno, you know, was part of her public persona. She was so concerned about child abuse. And so part of the reason, according to the narrative, is that she was willing to send in the tanks to stop the child abuse. You know, gassing the kids with CS gas, which can kill them, and when they didn't have gas masks that fit them, didn't matter. Janet Reno cares about children.
All right, more Jim Bovard right after this, guys.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I should have had all my Waco soundbites queued up and everything. I got some great ones. Oh, well. I'm on the line with the great Jim Bovard. He wrote a ton of great articles about Waco all this time. You can find many of them in his archives at jimbovard.com. Check out all his great books at Amazon, etc. So, Jim, now the fire. Oh, well, first, before the fire here, and there's a lot of kind of bigger issues to grapple with here, too. But I think the first knee-jerk answer that a defender of the cops would say is that, well, why didn't they just come out then? Took 51 days, this siege, between the initial ATF assault, if you want to call it that, and the time when Bill Clinton finally sent the Delta Force to finish them off 51 days later. Why didn't they just come out?
Well, there were some people who did come out, and they were slapped into handcuffs and leg chains and orange-type prison suits. I don't know if they were orange, but... And then they were marched in front of the TV cameras as if they were very dangerous felons. And that wasn't exactly the best way to persuade the other folks to come out. And there was the feds managed to dominate the media. Part of what they did is keep the media so far away from the side of the Davidians' home and also block contact between the folks inside and outside in order so the feds could control the narrative and thereby demonize the folks. And it was unfortunate that so many people were so gullible that the fact the government was, you know, spinning this story so heavily, it didn't matter. They still swallowed the government line. And from that perspective, there's a parallel, as you mentioned earlier, what the feds did with Saddam Hussein and how they were able to demonize the Iraqi peoples, that they didn't really matter, that shock and awe was fine because, okay, we're bombing Baghdad, but we're not really killing civilians because they're bad guys, or they supported the bad guys, and it was the same paradox which we've seen in U.S. foreign policy going back to the Kaiser, because what the government does at one point is say, well, those folks are living under a terrible terrible dictator, and at the same time, the U.S. government blames them for not changing the policy or not having a better leader. After they say that they're helpless. And that was how the government portrayed the people, saying that David Koresh had total control, and yet everybody in there, it was like joint and several liability, that anybody living in that house was liable for anything David Koresh did, so the government had the right to treat every one of them like that should treat David Koresh.
Yeah, it's the perfect parallel. And it goes further, too, where, he's crazy. Just like Saddam, he's a madman. He's so damn insane. And so there's no point in even trying to negotiate with him. Like, look at us. We're throwing up our hands because, by golly, we swear we've tried so hard to negotiate. But the man is just irrational. And then, of course, you have the illegal weapons. You have the international and the local level gun control going on in the name of full autos or mustard gas or whatever the lie is.
Yeah, and these are, it was interesting. There were, I guess, was it 49, 50 rifles that were charred leftovers of them after the fire. And prior to the 1995 congressional hearings, the Clinton administration blocked any independent examination of those rifles to determine if they were actually automatic or if they had been illegally converted. If my memory is correct on that, it's possible I'm wrong. But there was a lot of distortions with the evidence, and it was amazing that the Fed's case was so shaky, and yet they found a federal judge who was an utter disgrace to his robe, to his bat suit, who basically rubber stamped whatever the prosecutors wanted to do. And even though the jury in Texas, a Texas jury, basically threw out most of the harshest charges against the Branch Davidians, but the federal judge twisted things and then sentenced them to long prison, sentenced most of the survivors to a long prison time, even in spite of the jury's verdict.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, even if they were right that, oh, look, this rifle's been converted, when was it converted? During the siege or before it?
And the whole thing was, that's a good point. That's a good point.
And even if they had, then and this was what they put on the made-up warrant, was that they should have paid a tax on it. And then the way I remember reading it, although it's been a while, was that they had paid their taxes for the one full auto they did have or whatever it was.
Well, and not only that, but there is a gun culture in Texas, which is very different than many parts of the U.S., certainly very different than where the mainstream media comes from. And folks are very first of all, folks are casual about gun ownership, and they're also a lot more responsible than they are in some places in the big cities. So it didn't really matter what the Branch Davidians had because they were not out there assaulting anybody.
Right.
And not only that, but something which did not come out until long afterwards, thanks to David Hardy, was the feds, the undercover ATF agents had gone shooting with David Koresh like a week, 10 days before the ATF assault, and it would have been easy to arrest him then at that point. But they chose not to do that. Instead, it was Showtime, which was the name of the ATF operation, and they had, what was it, three or four different TV news crews that were supposed to be there. Feds could have very easily made an arrest, and they lied and covered that up. And if that information had come out on the day of the botched ATF assault, it would have been far more difficult for the Clinton administration, FBI, ATF, to demonize Koresh and the Davidians, and thereby to justify the final assault that left 80 people dead.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the most telling statements in that video about the guns is that, you know, this stockpile, as you call it, is just an inventory. They had a gun business. And, in fact, there's a guy named Paul Fatta who actually left. Boy, did they have a lot of guns. You talk about it was no big deal kind of a thing to them. He had a dually truck with a camper shell towing a U-Haul trailer, both full of rifles. And he left that morning, not in a secret getaway in a James Bond conspiracy type thing, but he just drove down to Austin for the gun show where he was selling those rifles down right at the corner of 290 and I-35 in Austin, Texas, with everybody else. And when he found out what was happening, in other words, he left with 90-something percent of the firearms that the Branch Davidians had to go and do perfectly harmless, legitimate, legal gun business, just like tens of thousands of other Texans do, gun business. Nothing black market or illegal. It's certainly nothing threatening to the people of Waco, like they were building a Branch Davidian army to march on City Hall or whatever we were supposed to fear from them. The guy left with all the guns for a completely innocuous reason, and when he found out about the raid, he called the FBI and said, "Well, I'm Paul Fatta, the gun dealer. Are you looking for me?" He was actually the one who was running the business for Koresh, so...
Yeah, but it didn't matter because the feds had their narrative, and almost all the media bought it, and it was that was how the feds were able to do the final assault. Because if they had been honest and open from the get-go, public support would have been much lower. And it took over 2 years before the public really turned against the government narrative on this. And even then, the hearings in July 2005, July 1995 were pretty much of a bust because most of the congressmen didn't have the balls to vigorously question federal agents and FBI officials.
Yep. Well, you know, it's known now that there were flashbang grenades were found at all three origins of the fire, that the CS was extremely flammable, and whether deliberately or not, the feds, the tank attack and the gas certainly helped lead, and probably those flashbangs helped lead to that fire. But then there's also the FLIR footage of the guys getting out of the backs of the tanks, which I guess we're to believe are a mix between the hostage rescue team and the Army's Delta Force. And it was really Lee Hancock at the Dallas Morning News, I guess, who broke the most stories about the Delta Force there. But there's clips in the second movie, Waco, A New Revelation, of a CIA officer, I think a currently serving CIA officer, and a former Special Forces officer, both saying that they had talked directly to the Delta Force guys, and they admitted their role in helping kill the Branch Davidians in what they call the firefight in the back of the house.
Yeah, and it was frustrating how the feds were able to sweep those allegations under the rug because the story broke in a fireball again in 1999, thanks largely to Mike McNulty and David Hardy. And Janet Reno said, well, you know, I'm very upset I was lied to by the FBI. So, and the thing that Reno did was find a stooge, former Senator John Danforth, who was so busy kissing her boots the whole time he was doing his independent investigation. And, of course, the final report came out whitewashing the FBI and the entire government and basically blaming the American people for not having believed that the government was not doing wonderful things there at Waco. And there was language in that Danforth report which captured the arrogance of Washington towards the American people, saying that it was I don't have the exact quote in front of me. I should. But it was basically condescending to people like, well, the people that as if there was a mental problem, a psychological problem that was widespread among the American people for thinking the government had done bad things at Waco, when even Danforth's report showed quite a few lies and cover-ups on top of all the ones that have been exposed from 1993 onwards.
Right. Yeah, I think I remember the quote where it's something close to, you know, the government's faith in the people has been shaken. You know, be trusted to be the sovereign in this society anymore? We're just going to have to take it all for ourselves.
Yeah, let me pull that up here. God damn it, helps if I do the right.
Go ahead, because I found my Special Forces quote here while you find that one.
All right.
I did talk to some combat applications group guys.
Here he goes.
And they did confirm that, yes, portions of B Squadron were there pulling triggers.
Pulling triggers. All right, sorry.
Okay, this is the quote from Danforth's preface. He said he hoped his findings will start the process of restoring the faith of the people and their government and the faith of the government in the people. So Danforth was saying government officials have been wrongly victimized by public distrust. And that, you know, that phrase of hoping it would help restore the government's faith in the people, it's like, you know, if there was any doubt about whose side Danforth was on, that settled it.
Yeah. Well, listen, I already kept you into the break, but it's the long top of the hour break. So let me ask you one more thing to please comment, if you would, about what role you think Waco had and the American people and the media and all the consensus acquiescence to what happened there, at least at first. And whether you think that that has really had an effect on the rest of policing in America. Because, you know, it seems like people go, yeah, occasionally things like Waco happen. And actually, things like Waco happen 100 times a day, right? It's just usually the people don't dare fight back, and certainly they don't win and have a 51-day standoff. That was what was unique. But as far as the ATF-style, you know, Colin Powell doctrine, overwhelming force raid first thing in the morning or in the middle of the night, this kind of thing, this is an hourly occurrence in the United States of America. But it wasn't then, was it, Jim? And do you think that this helped change that?
Yeah, I would not say it was a daily or an hourly occurrence, but certainly since 1993, 1994, there was a vast increase in the number of SWAT teams, and there was a change in how they operated because the SWAT teams became much more violent and preemptive. It was almost as if they were driven by some kind of assumption that every possible suspect was like David Koresh or some kind of like every house that they were going to was an armed compound, so they had to do the overwhelming force. And that is that's one of the biggest legacies of the change in the relationship between the federal government and government at all levels and the American people, because the politicians and the bureaucrats saw what the FBI got away with at Waco and say, hey, let's use more force because it works for us, it's fun, and they enjoy domineering.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty sure I read that it was something like 50 SWAT raids a day on average in America.
Could be.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think some of the SWAT raids are not like they're all on hooped up on steroids and amphetamines, but there's certainly that kind of potential.
Yeah.
And it's a change in how the government relates to the people, and it's a very ugly change.
Yeah, it seems like. I remember then thinking that at least de facto it served as a test to see just how far they can go and what we'll put up with. And then the answer was, hell, we can barbecue 100 of them right in front of God and everybody, and now back to the Price is Right, and they'll be happy. So there's nothing we can't do, apparently.
Well, I think that they overestimated their part of what happened was that some of the truth came out, and that really hurt the government's credibility, and I think that made the FBI a little more cautious. For instance, in the 1996 showdown with the Freeman group up there in Montana, the FBI actually showed restraint, and that was why they were able to get a peaceful solution, didn't have to kill the people. So,
I think that may be part of why they didn't do anything about the Nazis at Elohim City that blew up Oklahoma, like we're about to have to talk about with Roger Charles in just a second. Thank you very much for your time on the show. I really appreciate it, Jim.
Hey, thanks a lot, Scott.
Always great to talk to you.
All right, bye-bye.
That's the great Jim Bovard, everybody. Find him at jimbovard.com. He's got a bunch of great articles from back then and more recent about Waco. And he's written a whole mess of books, Lost Rights, Terrorism and Tyranny, Attention Deficit Democracy, Freedom in Chains, and... the latest is his memoir, Public Policy Hooligan. It's really great. We'll be right back in just a sec. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Next up is Roger G. Charles. He is the author with Andrew Gumbel of the book Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters. He was previously a news producer for ABC 2020, right? Welcome back, Roger. How are you?
Good to be with you. I was not actually a producer. I was an associate producer and consultant.
Oh, there you go. Well, anyway. But that's how you got turned on to this story in the first place. Am I right about that?
That is correct. A guy named Don Thrasher, unfortunately no longer with us, hired me to be his assistant as he was in 1996 beginning to peel back the onion, so to speak, and try to make sense of what was obviously a myth constructed by the federal government as to what really happened in the Oklahoma City bombing and who was really involved and so on.
All right, now, your co-author, Andrew Gumbel, has a new piece for the anniversary here, running in The Guardian, and he has this...
I have seen it, yes.
Uh-huh. And so he has a quote here from Larry Mackey, the number two prosecutor against McVeigh, and, it's just a very cop way of putting things, if you ask me, but you can tell what he means, where he says, if you had said to us, does anybody in the room have 100% confidence that McVeigh was alone? If so, raise your hand. we would have all kept our hands in our laps. So, in other words, if you believe McVeigh had help that we didn't prosecute, raise your hand. They would have all raised their hands. They all believe that they let people get away with mass murder. That's a quote from, slightly unpacked, but not really, from Larry Mackey, the number two federal prosecutor against McVeigh. So whoever could he be referring to, Roger?
You know, there's no question that some of the Midwest bank robbers, the Aryan Republic Army, if that's what you want to call them, Pete Langan, Richard Guthrie, and their crew, had some sort of role. I've just finished some review and research for a piece that will be coming out over the weekend, probably, updating people on what we know about Andreas Carl Strassmeyer, who's clearly now, I can say, the evidence is overwhelming. People on the record and off the record, but on the record, a number of people that Strassmeyer was, at a minimum, an informant and very likely a provocateur in the center of the conspiracy. And as much as I've done this for the last almost 19 years now, Scott, I'm still just, when I put it all together, it just kind of amazes me how lazy or whatever largely the mainstream media was. Not everybody, but the exceptions were rare. They just swabbed the government's line, hook, line, and sinker, and consequently, people with direct responsibility for the murder of 168 of our fellow citizens have escaped any kind of accountability. And that includes, by the way, the people in the federal government that had some idea of a threat, and I'm not talking about a vague threat, but knew with varying degrees of specificity that Oklahoma City was a target and failed to take whatever actions were necessary to prevent the bombing from taking place. And that's really what's driving the cover-up for these 20 years, and that's what has driven the use of the victims and the survivors' families, the victims and their families, their survivors and families. What has really driven the cover-up to success has been using the grief of these people as the cement to kind of hold the stone wall together. And it's just incredible.
Yeah, you're right about that. They've always, from the very beginning, it's sort of like 9/11 where, yeah, they might as well have done it. Hell, it makes no difference whether they did it because they exploited it so cynically that, you might as well, conclude that absolutely they sent Strassmeyer to do this just so they could exploit it was how bad they exploited it. Whether that's exactly how it happened or not, I think, as you seem to imply there, is still a bit debatable. But boy, did they ever exploit it. If people go back and remember all the spinning and all the PR and, where even Rush Limbaugh, who is to me the very center right in American politics, right? Anyone to the right of him, and maybe even including him, were all responsible for the Oklahoma bombing, what with all their anti-government rhetoric and this kind of thing. And, never even mind the story. For the story, they switched to O.J. Simpson, as far as what actually happened. Let's talk about O.J. But as far as who you're supposed to hate out of it, how about every gun owner in America? Yep, they did it. And meanwhile, even when they executed McVeigh, they were all surprised. Wow, he came in with his head shaved all the way to the skin like some kind of Nazi. Yeah, you sort of missed the whole Nazi angle. They're busy blaming every militia and every patriot and every right-wing populist in America, and they missed the actual Nazis that did it. And why again? Because some of them were provocateurs, and through others of them, the government had prior knowledge the attack was going to happen, but then didn't stop it.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a pathetic chapter in the history of American journalism because the evidence in bits and pieces is out there, and I've been fortunate to work with some great people, John D. Cash, a mutual friend of ours, God rest his soul. did some amazing work along with his editor, publisher, the McCurtain County Gazette, Bruce Willingham. Their work will stand when the New York Times and a lot of the other mainstream media, the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, their work will be an embarrassment at some point in the future in schools of journalism for its shoddiness and its superficiality and its and the willingness of these supposedly first-rate journalists to question in any serious way the government spinmeisters and liars. It's as much as I've watched it, I shake my head. It's still just kind of hard to believe. And let me just bring up one other point that you raised, Scott. In a great book by Ambrose Evans Pritchett mm-hmm. called The Secret Life of Bill Clinton, Ambrose gets into, and this came out of a Washington Post article that I pointed out to Andrew, or Ambrose, the day that Clinton flew back from Arkansas to D.C., the day after the 1996 election, he's been reelected. So it's the day after. He's in Air Force One flying back to Washington. He's feeling great. He's just got four more years. And he kind of saunters back to the press room on Air Force One, and guess what? He commits a little bit of truth, one of the rare times in his life. And he credits the Oklahoma City bombing as the reason for his reelection, because they were able to exploit it.
Yeah, that is a true story. The Oklahoma City bombing saved my presidency, he said.
Yeah.
As though Bob Dole was ever really a threat anyway, but still, it certainly did change him from, on the defensive to on the offensive, that's for sure, politically speaking.
Yeah.
Yep.
But anyhow, I think of J.D., and particularly as we come up to the 20th anniversary, and miss him greatly, and I'm just consider myself fortunate to have been with him and worked with him as we did.
Me too, and, absolutely.
And let me just say that I feel badly in the book that you so kindly referenced that Andrew Gumbel and I published, 2012, 3 years ago now.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Gumbel had written twice that referring and characterizing John Cash as an amateur reporter. And I caught one and had it corrected. I did not catch the second instance where he used that kind of cheap shot against John. And I greatly regret that I missed the second instance, and hope that John will forgive me.
All right.
I think
he
will.
All right. Hold it right there, Roger. We got to take this break. We'll be right back. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. All right, I'm back. It's my show here. I'm here, yeah. Scott Horton's show, talking with Roger Charles. And, Roger, it is too bad the way the editor and or your co-author got to J.D. Cash's legacy in that book. And so I'm glad that you were able to take the time. I'm sorry if a little bit of it got cut off by the break there for the live audience. But anyway, he was a good man, and he did good journalism. And I don't remember him being caught being wrong on what happened here really at all. And so anyway... Yeah, God rest his soul and all that kind of thing. So I want to go back to what you were saying, though, about the media here. I saw an AP reporter this morning tweeted out about, be very careful with breaking news because, and the story didn't really get much wrong, but it was, maybe some Muslims did it or something like that was in there. But it was very vague and not very accusatory. But anyway, he was saying this is a warning for reporting things on breaking news. And, I replied back that, this whole story is you know, very illustrative of the problems of access journalism altogether. And in fact, the Associated Press is the best example that I can think of, because especially right around the time of the federal trials in Colorado, I didn't say all this in the tweet, but you understand. Right around the time of the federal trials, the AP would actually do some pretty good reporting on some of the other John Does and some of the other things that were known that were being left out of the prosecution story, like, for example, the ATF informant Carol Howe, but they never would pick it up and run with it. Hey, everybody, here's a 3,000-word story about Carol Howe. We'll never talk about this again. You know, like, that was, to me, the biggest outrage was where, you know, you have newspaper, you know, so that means the editor of the Austin American Statesman, he saw that story come over the wire but didn't run it, right? You could only read it in the Rocky Mountain News or in the Denver Post or something like that. And
well, you know, going back to John Cash and Bruce Willingham and the McCurtain Daily Gazette, they could never get the AP office in Oklahoma City to pick up a single one of the groundbreaking, incredible stories that John did for that paper. They had orders from somebody. And I'll tell you one. I know this for a fact because the guy involved told me. A former deputy bureau chief of the AP here in Washington, D.C., had a story about a candidate for Senate who he had the goods on, and I had helped in this a little bit, using his office to enrich himself by getting a designation for a certain federal status for some that would benefit this senator's sitting senator running for re-election, would benefit his real estate holdings, okay? The guy was going to run the story, but his boss, the bureau chief for AP here in Washington, D.C., refused to do it because the candidate that was running against the sitting senator was Jim Webb. And Jim Webb had written an article critical of women in the military years ago. And this bureau chief was a woman, and she told the deputy, "We're not going to run your story. I don't want to do anything. It's going to help that misogynist." Now, excuse me, the story either stands or doesn't on its own merits. You've either got it sourced, you've either got the evidence, or you don't. In this case, there was no question about it. The evidence was there.
Yep. All right, so give us the rundown about, name some names for us. Tell us the story of who was John Doe 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in this thing.
Well, you know, there are several John Doe 2s, and that's a good point, Scott, because it's hard to say, depending on where you place the individual, which one you're talking about. Was it one of the Ward brothers? Was it Mike Brescia? Was it Richard Lee Guthrie? Was it, you know, there's some people say even Andy Strassmeyer was John Doe, too. I don't believe that. But, I mean, you've got to be very specific because these guys were similar enough and personal identification by a witness is weak enough, well-known now, that you just can't say that John Doe, too, was this one individual. You can say, who was the guy at Eldon Elliott's Ryder Rental Truck franchise in Junction City, Kansas, when John Doe 1, who I do not believe was Timothy McVeigh, by the way, when John Doe 1 rented the Ryder Rental Truck? Who was that? Well, you've got to, you know, really get into some specifics there. And so was it A, B, or C? I don't know, but it was not. The key point there is that I do not believe that John Doe 1 was Tim McVeigh. You look at the height and weight. You look at where he was on the it doesn't even come close to matching what the people said in terms of the height and weight of the guy that rented the truck. If you look at the McDonald's security camera at the McDonald's about a mile and a quarter away, mm-hmm. There's no way that McVeigh could have gotten walking from there to the rental truck office in the amount of time in the light rain.
Well, and I
so
think,
on.
Roger, in your book, better than anywhere else, you guys show that there were two Ryder trucks. And the most obvious reason why was that, hey, obviously the FBI is onto us, so we're going to get another truck, and they can chase the red herring while we go ahead and blow up the building with this thing. And it sure took more than McVeigh to arrange all that. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, I from fairly early on in this thing, in late July of 96 when I first got involved, it became apparent to me that when you started looking at all these issues, there was somebody, and I just call him the evil genius. It may have been a person. It may have been a small group of people. It may have been a man. It may have been a woman. I have no idea. But the guiding intellect for this attack was what I called the evil genius. And the evil genius knew with certainty a couple things. One, that if you had more than two people in a conspiracy, one of them was going to be a government informant. And maybe with just two of them, one of them might be. But he certainly knew as many people as were involved, there would be at least a government informant and maybe a couple.
Especially when they're all neo-Nazi bank robbers and white supremacists who are all guilty of felonies and have all been flipped to be witnesses or informants at one point or another.
So, and then secondly, he said, you know, I'm going to turn that and use that disadvantage, that liability, I'm going to flip it and use it to my benefit. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to identify who this informant or these informants are. I am going to feed them this information, and that will protect our plan. And so part of it was the decoy rider truck. I don't want to get into all of it now with the time we have left, but believe me, there's ample evidence or compelling evidence.
Absolutely there is, yeah.
Decoy truck being used, and it lulled the federal law enforcement into a false sense of complacency and security that they had things under control. McVeigh comes in the back door, so to speak, with the bomb truck, blows up the daycare center, which was his target, I am convinced.
Hey, Roger, let me keep you one more segment, can I?
How long will that be, Scott?
10 minutes after the break, so 15,
okay.
Really?
Yeah, 10 or 15, okay.
Okay, great. I'll let you go right after that. It's Roger Charles, author of Oklahoma City. Read that. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back. And thanks to Roger Charles for staying a little bit extra with us here today to talk about Oklahoma City. It's 20 years now. God, I can hardly believe it. It's 20 years. He's the author of the book, Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Matters. His co-author has a piece at The Guardian today where, like in the book, the prosecutors themselves are quoted admitting that they knew that they let guilty Oklahoma City bombers escape. And their measly excuse is they had to make sure to be able to get a death penalty verdict against McVeigh. Not to shut him up or anything, but just to make an example out of him for the rest of you. But then that's their excuse for letting others get away with it. And, of course, there's a BBC documentary where the lead FBI investigator says the same thing, too, that, you know, there's this broader network of neo-Nazis that did this. And remember the narrative, if you remember back then 20 years ago, the narrative was, again, the militia did it, but the patriots did it, but not the Nazis did it, when actually the Nazis did it. And that's what we're talking about here is, you know, the small handful of guys that are known to have been McVeigh's associates. And by the way, it's worth mentioning that they didn't put anyone on the stand in McVeigh's federal trial to testify that they saw him there that morning in the yellow rider truck, that he got out of it, that they saw him run toward the alley where the Mercury was parked or anything like this. And it's not because they had no eyewitnesses. There were all kinds of eyewitnesses. I believe 20 to 24 different eyeball witnesses put him in Oklahoma City that morning, but nobody saw him alone. And so the FBI and the federal prosecutors just didn't bother putting anyone on the stand. Instead, they interviewed little kids about how sad they were that they lost their family. And that was the prosecution testimony against McVeigh. And sorry, I'm going on one more point, Roger, which is I have somewhere the clip of a juror from that case on 60 Minutes saying, well, you know, I kept waiting around for the defense to bring in like an alibi witness to say there's no way McVeigh did it because he was with me that day, and that never happened. And so that was how desperate she was to figure out a way to convict, that she flipped the standard of evidence entirely on him, that he had to prove himself innocent in the face of the fact that she had gone through all this and hadn't seen a shred of evidence that he did it. Even though you and I both know he's guilty as hell, it's just they couldn't provide any evidence that wouldn't show on cross-examination that they had major problems with the rest of their story.
Yeah, well, you know, it's taken a while, Scott, for me to come to this realization, and this is a fairly recent one. I don't know why it took so long, but, you know, and I worked for Stephen Jones, as you may recall, on the defense team for about 4 months during the trial in Denver and shortly thereafter. There were four parties to the trial. You had the accused, McVeigh. You had his defense team, Stephen Jones. Then you had the prosecution representing the federal government, the FBI, the ATF, and so on. Then you had the judge, Judge Richard Meech, representing the independent judicial branch of our government. Well, here's how the team stacked up. You had Stephen Jones against his own client, Tim McVeigh, in the sense that McVeigh did not want Jones to be successful in raising the issue of the others involved. McVeigh was the designated patsy. That was his willing role. He eagerly accepted it. And as a martyr, he was going to go to his death protecting his fellow bomb conspiracy guys. So he had Jones against his own client, who was working to keep the broader conspiracy out of the trial. The government did not want, the Justice Department part of the government did not want that introduced, and the judge did not. Now, he says at the end, and it's in the book, our book, we quote him as saying, I hope the FBI and Justice Department will continue investigating. Well, at that point, it's too late. He's already given them all they needed to build the brick wall. Now, you may remember the name John Sirica.
He was the judge. No, remind me.
Okay, he was the federal judge in Washington, D.C. When the Watergate burglars were brought before him, there had been a deal cut, and the Justice Department was part of it. They were going to plead guilty. They did plead guilty. They were going to take a kind of a 1 or 2 years in jail. Their families were going to be taken care of by money from the Nixon slush funds, and everything would just go on without a ripple. Well, Judge Sirica knew a BS deal when he saw one. He refused to accept their guilty pleas and said, this court will not be party to this fraud. Well, Judge Richard Meech in Denver had exactly the same opportunity. He saw a fraud being perpetrated on his court, and for whatever reason, his personal animus against maybe not McVeigh, but against what McVeigh had done, that so wounded Meech, a believer in law and order and the rule of law and all that, but Meech refused to support Stephen Jones' attempts to raise the issue of the broader conspiracy. So you had Meech, you had the Justice Department, and you had Tim McVeigh all fighting to keep the lid on this thing. And it's no wonder that Stephen Jones had to wait and write a book about others unknown, because his client and the other parties I just mentioned didn't want to let it in court.
Right. Yeah, and again, back to what you said at the beginning here, this was all obvious at the time for anyone with a critical eye who wanted to look. In real time, you could see this slow motion train wreck going on in terms of the kangaroo court atmosphere, really, in Denver there where they held the trial, where, you know, even the proof that it was ammonium nitrate and that McVeigh did it was, they said they found a receipt at Nichols' house with McVeigh's thumbprint on it for ammonium nitrate. And then that's how much they knew was in it, everything else. It all was based on this one receipt, they said. And then,
well, and I'll tell you, I'm convinced, having studied it in some detail, that Tim McVeigh planted that receipt in Terry Nichols' kitchen drawer.
Yeah, it seemed likely even at the time. But you then know, you also had Frederick Whitehurst from the FBI crime lab who, you know, debunked their phony science and said, you know, they basically pretended that they had some ammonium nitrate crystals on a piece of plywood that they never even tested right, et cetera.
No, you could not today, and this was true probably just right after the trials, they could not go and find ammonium nitrate crystals sufficient to definitively determine in a lab test that there was anywhere around. Whether it had been used in fertilizing the shrubs and grass on the lawn of the Murrah building, or it was there because of the bomb. I mean, the whole thing, the science was so weak, so flawed. The whole thing was just pathetic, and yet the gullible mainstream media, which I shouldn't say gullible, in this case serving basically as a hand puppet for the establishment that wanted this thing to be solved quickly and, you know, slick Willie to go unencumbered into his second 4 years. A lot of that was at play here, Scott, believe me. And I don't say that as a partisan. I'm a libertarian independent. I don't really have anything to do with either party anymore. But it's a sad commentary. And we're watching it play out in other stories, the same thing. You can see the whole thing to get us to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Iraq. Yeah. You know, where was the skepticism? Where was the professional journalism that was going to say, prove your accusations, your allegations? Let's see the evidence. And that pathetic performance by Colin Powell in front of the United Nations will embarrass him and will basically be what he's remembered for, not the other things that he did. And it's only fair because he knew when he got up there that this was not sufficient to go to war. But he went ahead and used his prestige to support the lie. Anyhow, I don't want to get off on that, but it's all part and parcel of the same problems that we have today.
Yep, you're right. It is. The point being, it's just out of control. Where's the control? Where's the accountability? It's Roger Charles, author of the book Oklahoma City. Thanks very much, Roger. I appreciate it.
Good to be with you, my friend. Take care.
You hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right. So, yeah, hey, that book on Oklahoma City, it's not the end all, but, man, it's pretty damn good. Yeah, it's pretty much all you need to know. Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Still Matters by Roger Charles and Andrew Gumbel. It's pretty damn good. And Jim Bovard, again, jimbovard.com. You can read all kind of articles about Waco that he wrote over the years, about the various stages of the cover-up, sticking up for the innocent there. And again, I'll say this a million times over. All you got to do is pull it up on YouTube, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, and the sequel, Waco, A New Revelation. And then if you're really into it, The FLIR Project is now again on YouTube, at least last time I checked. And assuming my website is up, actually, for many of you hearing this later in recorded format, that means the website is back up, presumably, if you're not listening live right now. If you're listening live right now, well, you'll just have to wait. But for the rest of you, go to scotthorton.org, and then there's documentaries/documentaries. And I have all three of them embedded there for you in the documentaries category there. And the FLIR Project, that's the one that proves with the infrared footage who was shooting who, this, that, and the rest. Proves it. Proves the Danforth, the cover-up nature of the Danforth investigation there. Anyway, it's important. So now, I couldn't help but laugh at that. Oh, I don't need these damn headphones on anymore. I couldn't help but laugh at the, did you see where Admiral Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is just downplaying the loss of Ramadi? Oh, losing Ramadi? Eh, that's not that big of a deal. Now, remember I mentioned that David Enders had gone there for Vice and done a little video report from there. Not little, I don't know, 15-minute, 20-minute video report about, I guess Ramadi is bisected by the Tigris or the Euphrates, one or the other, I don't know. I'm not going to guess, I forget. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Well, it does to them, but not to me right now. So ISIS, in the David Enders report, the Islamic State had control of half the town or so, maybe more than half the town, on one side of the river. And the people on the other side of the river were the holdouts from what's left of the Iraqi government there. And I guess they did have an Awakening Council Sunni leader type there. But he's way overmatched. And the Shiites in Baghdad, as much as they say they want to destroy ISIS, they don't want to do anything to help the Sunni tribal chiefs and Awakening guys and members of the Iraqi government who are trying at all to fight on their side. Or they're certainly not doing enough to help them, it doesn't look like. And so, but it looks like the last of everybody's trying to get the hell out of there now because the Islamic State is, I presume, crossing the river, finishing the consolidation over their town of Ramadi. So, Tikrit supposedly has been liberated. I don't know how many Islamic State fighters still remain in Tikrit. And liberated, yes, I use the term figuratively or, you know, ironically, to whatever degree you want to take it. But the Islamic State, at least, has been kicked out of there. But, you know, they're announcing that there's going to be a giant offensive in the Anbar province. That's Fallujah and Ramadi and the lands mostly to the west, you know, the more or less the due west of Baghdad. And, it goes up to the north of it too. And yet they can't, the, Baghdad government, that is, the American and Iranian backed government in Baghdad and their Iranian militias and their American Air Force, they can't even keep the Islamic State out of this town of Baiji. If, I'm probably not saying that right, but anyway. The Baiji refinery. Well, there's a town and then there's a refinery. And control of both keeps changing hands. And I think only one time, actually, the government forces were able to take control of it, but then they couldn't hang on to it. Actually, no, I think that happened twice. I think that happened early on. They had a pretty significant assault, but then were shortly thereafter driven away. And now the same thing again. But anyway, this is a much smaller town than Tikrit, and Tikrit is a much smaller town than Fallujah or Ramadi or Mosul. And it sure seems to me like a flight of imagination or something that somehow the newly retrained again Iraqi army with the Bada Brigade and Mahdi Army militias coordinated with the Iranian Quds Force, that these guys are going to go and drive the Islamic State out of these massive towns. And you could see how, on the face of it, at least it would make sense on the face of it for America to back the same parties that George Bush has backed since 2003 and that Obama has been the de facto ally of, I guess, pretty much, has stayed the ally of the Baghdad government since then, along with the Iranians since 2003 and all the way through. It makes sense to fight them against the Islamic State, right? And only, actually, not really, because it never made sense to fight for the Shiite militias, the Iranian-backed Shiite militias, in the first place. And to continue to back them in their war against the Islamic State is only to further drive more Sunnis into their grip. The only way that that's a sure bet the other way would be to put in a couple of maybe few hundred thousand troops to just smash the crap out of any organizing militant force anywhere in there. But look at what a hard time America had doing that for 6, 7, 8 years straight there in occupying Iraq, and especially in the Sunni areas. And that was with, at one point, as many as 150,000 men there. So it would take not just all the Iraqi army or Shiite militias. It would take the United States to, I think, outright put many troops on the ground to drive these guys out of the bigger cities there, especially Fallujah and Mosul. And so, you know, when Patrick Coburn says, don't underestimate the strength of these guys, I take that seriously, you know? They're not a real state, but maybe they don't really need to be. They're a real bunch of fighters, and they do have state boundaries, and they enforce them. But anyway, so in other words, I guess if you just completely dropped H-bombs on Sunni Stan, then at that point, that would have its own repercussions. But at least you wouldn't be driving more Sunnis into the Islamic State's hands, because they'll all be dead. But short of that, basically anything we do to ally with the Shiites against the Sunnis only makes matters worse for us with the Sunnis, rather than better. The more likely end of the Islamic State is the same most likely end of Al-Qaeda, although, boy, the light years and leaps and bounds in power and influence that they have gained since the Bush and Obama administrations is just absolutely incredible. But still, I think the most likely solution to their problem is their own radicalism. And we saw when Al-Qaeda, and all is the Islamic State is Al-Qaeda in principle. The only difference is chain of command. They don't listen to Zawahiri anymore, but they still claim Osama. And they're still the legacy of al-Zarqawi and Iraqi Al-Qaeda from the last war. And they made enemies out of everybody. The people that they were fighting for turned on them and shot them all to death and said, you know, you can help us fight our enemies, but you can't become our enemies and take us over too, and blamed them. And so, of course, David Petraeus and American TV take credit for the whole thing. Oh, the surge worked and this and that. But all the surge did was just keep the war going long enough until the Shiite militias were done cleansing Baghdad of its Sunnis, and you know, declared victory at that point by withdrawing from the fight. But the Sunni militias were already taking on the Islamic State, or you know, what was then, yeah, they were trying to call themselves the Islamic State of Iraq, and the local Iraqis were like, no man, this isn't how we do business here. Then they were nothing again until Obama helped them out in Syria for the last 4 years. Music's playing, so I'm done for today. But anyway, you knew that. But the Fall Ramadi, don't worry about it. I agree, I guess. Who cares?